I, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, do solemnly swear.
I, Harry S. Truman, do solemnly swear.
I, Dwight D. Eisenhower, do solemnly swear.
I, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, do solemnly swear.
I, Lyndon Baines Johnson, do solemnly swear.
The presidency, said Herbert Hoover, is more than an administrative office. It must be the symbol of American ideals. It must be the instrument by which national conscience is leavened. The presidency of the United States, established in broadest outline by the Constitution almost two centuries ago, has grown with our nation, has changed, has been molded in the crucible of our common national experience, has reflected always the views, aspirations, strengths, and weaknesses of the men who have occupied the White House. In our time, the presidency of the United States has become the most powerful office in the free world. Depression in the 1930s, war in the 1940s, witnessed a dramatic and permanent enlargement of presidential responsibilities. And the man who is president of the United States today truly speaks to the aspirations of vast segments of the world's population. Beginning with Franklin D. Roosevelt in the crisis of this nation's Great Depression, here, in the words of the men who have given the office its present shape, is the presidency, the responsibilities, the burdens, some of the satisfactions of the office today. These are the men who know the office best. Let us listen to them as they speak so personally, so knowingly, of the presidency of the United States.
I, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. So help me God.
Franklin D. Roosevelt took office during the most severe economic depression this country has ever known. Action was needed quickly. And in his inspiring inaugural address of March 4, 1933, President Roosevelt did move quickly to define the situation and to suggest measures to be taken by the government. Doing so, he made it clear that he would bring to bear on the nation's crisis the full powers of the office of the president.
President Hoover, Mr. Chief Justice, my friends, this is a day of national consecration. And I am certain that on this day, my fellow Americans expect that on my induction into the presidency, I will address them with a candor and a decision which the present situation of our people impels. This is preeminently the time to speak the truth, the whole truth, frankly, and boldly. Nor need we shrink from honestly facing conditions in our country today. This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive and will prosper. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance. In every dark hour of our national life, a leadership of frankness and of vigor has met with that understanding and support of the people themselves which is essential to victory. And I am convinced that you will again give that support to leadership in these critical days. This nation is asking for action, and action now. The people of the United States have not failed. In their need, they have registered a mandate that they want direct, vigorous action. They have asked for discipline and direction under leadership. They have made me the present instrument of their wishes. In the spirit of the gift, I take it. In this dedication of a nation, we humbly ask the blessing of God. May He protect each and every one of us. May He guide me in the days to come.
President Roosevelt felt that the times demanded immediate, vigorous presidential leadership, and indeed that such leadership was desired by the American people. Thus, there was no question in the years that followed that the office of the president occupied center stage in Washington and throughout the nation.
To the President of the United States, there come every day thousands of messages of appeal, of protest, of support, of information and advice, messages from rich and poor, from businessman and farmer, from factory employee and relief worker, messages from every part of our wide land. Those messages reflect the most striking feature of the life of this generation, the feature which men who live mentally in another generation can least understand, the ever-accelerating speed with which social forces now gather headway.
FDR repeatedly said that the president must see the nation as a whole, a duty which at many times during his years in office would lead him away from the Capitol.
Did you ever stop to think that there are, after all, only two positions in the nation that are filled by the vote of all of the voters, the presidency and the vice presidency? That makes it particularly necessary for the vice president and for me to conceive of our duty towards the entire country. The most difficult place in the world to get a clear and open perspective of the country as a whole is Washington. And I am reminded sometimes of what President Wilson once said. So many people come to Washington who know things that are not so, and so few people who know anything about what the people of the United States are thinking about. That is why I occasionally leave this scene of action for a few days to go fishing or to go back home to Hyde Park so that I can have a chance to think quietly about the country as a whole, to get away from the trees, as they say, and to look at the whole forest. This duty of seeing the country in a long-range perspective is one which in a very special manner attaches to this office to which you have chosen me.
Franklin Roosevelt in 1936 was elected to a second term in office by a landslide vote. Yet there was frequent criticism of his extremely broad interpretation of presidential powers, and so the president felt obliged to define his role relative to that of the other branches of government.
Last Thursday, I described the American form of government as a three-horse team provided by the Constitution to the American people so that their field might be plowed. The three horses are, of course, the three branches of government, the Congress, the executive, and the courts. Those who have intimated that the President of the United States is trying to drive that team overlook the simple fact that the president as chief executive is himself one of the three horses. It is the American people themselves who are in the driver's seat. It is the American people themselves who want the furrow plowed. I hope that you have reread the Constitution of the United States in these past few weeks. Like the Bible, it ought to be read again and again.
Still, it was increasingly clear that the scope of government had been hugely enlarged, and that governmental activities had become more intimately associated with the lives of Americans than ever before. FDR saw this, but he felt that it was necessary, even as prosperity was returning to the country.
Sometimes I get bored sitting in Washington hearing certain people talk and talk about all that government ought not to do. Americans do not look on government as an interloper in their affairs. On the contrary, they regard it as the most effective form of organized self-help. That is why they ask government not to stop governing. Prosperity has come back a long way. It is refreshing and feel the common wisdom that the time to repair the roof is when the sun is shining.
So the office of the president grew, and near the midpoint of his second term in office, President Roosevelt, amid speculation that he might seek an unprecedented third term, looked to the future.
Distinguished a member of the Congress came to the general, and I said to him, John, I want it personal to me. Something that you have a right to hear from my own lips. I have a great ambition in life. My friend pricked up his ears. I went on. I am by no means satisfied with having the United States parties. My great ambition, 1941, turn over the desk and chair in the White House and chair with the assurance that I'm turning over to him as a nation intact, a nation at peace, a nation that the Democratic national government can and will succeed.
But FDR's ambition to relinquish the presidency was never to be fulfilled. It was eased, a dangerous intruder and more threatening. 40. With much of the world at war, President Roosevelt did run for a third term, was again reelected. And within a year of his third inaugural ceremony, the United States, too, was at war.
December 7th, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. As Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy, I have directed that all measures be taken for our defense. With confidence in our armed forces, with the unbounding determination of our people, we will gain the inevitable triumph, so help us God.
The entry of the United States, inevitably, that the burdens and responsibilities of the man who was president would increase. Franklin Roosevelt spoke to the nation of his new wartime duties.
The responsibilities of the president in wartime to protect the nation are very grave. This total war, with our fighting fronts all over the world, makes the use of the executive power far more essential than in any previous war. If we were invaded, the people of this country would expect the president to use any and all means to repel the invader. Now the revolution and the war between the states were fought on our own soil. But today this war will be won or lost on other continents and in remote seas. I cannot tell what powers may have to be exercised in order to win this war. The American people can be sure that I will use my powers with a full sense of responsibility to the Constitution and to my country. And when the war is won, the powers under which I act will automatically revert to the people of the United States, to the people to whom those powers belong.
As presidential responsibilities grew under the stress of crisis, the Great Depression followed by the most destructive war in human history, Franklin Roosevelt touched upon a theme that all of the men who would follow him in the presidency would later echo.
In Washington, as you know, the working day of the presidency in these times averages about 15 hours. And even when I go to Hyde Park or to Warm Springs, the White House office, the callers, the visitors, and the telephones all follow me.
And it was at Warm Springs, in Georgia, under the most intense pressures a man can bear, that a weary Franklin Roosevelt died suddenly on April 12, 1945, only a few months after taking office for a fourth term. Harry S. Truman of Missouri, as Vice President of the United States, immediately succeeded to the highest office of the land.
On April 12, 1945, I've been presiding over the Senate in my capacity as Vice President. When the Senate recessed about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I walked over to the office of the Speaker of the House, Mr. Rayburn, to discuss pending legislation. As soon as I arrived, I was told that Mr. Early, one of President Roosevelt's secretaries, wanted me to call. I reached Mr. Early, and he told me to come to the White House as quickly as possible, to enter by way of the Pennsylvania Avenue entrance, and to come to Mrs. Roosevelt's study. When I arrived, Mrs. Roosevelt told me the tragic news, and I felt the shock that all of you felt a little later when the word came over the radio and appeared in the newspapers. President Roosevelt had died. I offered to do anything I could for Mrs. Roosevelt, and then asked the Secretary of State to call the Cabinet together. At 7:09 p.m., I was sworn in as President by Chief Justice Stone in the Cabinet room.
When Harry Truman became President of the United States, the Second World War was in its final days. The enormous burdens of the presidency in wartime would, presumably, lessen as hostilities ceased. This had always been the case after previous wars. But in 1945, the very method of ending the war made presidential responsibilities even more overwhelming. President Truman himself made the decision to drop the first atomic bomb, thus ushering in the atomic age. And not long after the Second World War came to a close, a new hostility, the Cold War, increased the tensions confronting country and president.
I suppose that history will remember my term in office as the years when the Cold War began to overshadow our lives. I have had hardly a day in office that has not been dominated by this all-embracing struggle, this conflict between those who love freedom and those who would lead the world back into slavery and darkness. And always in the background, there has been the atomic bomb.
Harry Truman inherited the vast machinery of the presidential office, so greatly enlarged during the Depression and the Second World War. And in his role as leader of the free world, presidential power and prestige continued to grow. President Truman, as FDR had before him, made full use of his powers, though he was fond of seeing them in simple but basic ways. His descriptions of the presidency have themselves become a part of our history.
I'm only the servant of the people of the United States. I can only do what the law authorizes me to do as President of the United States. I'm the enforcement part of the government of the United States for the laws that are passed by the Congress. That's my duty. That's what I'm sworn to do. People talk about the powers of the President and what a powerful executive he is and what he can do. Well, let me tell you something from experience. The president may have a great many powers given to him in the Constitution and may have powers under certain laws which are given to him by the Congress of the United States. But the principal power that the president has is to bring people in and try to persuade them to do what they ought to do without persuasion. That's what he spends most of his time doing. That's what the powers of the president amount to.
All the same, President Truman well knew the special character that attaches to the presidency.
I think every person, I don't care what his politics is, appreciates that the office of the president, not the man that's in it, is due a certain respect. I don't understand sometimes the kudos that I get, unless I think back to the time when I was about 18 years old, when I saw the first president of the United States that I ever saw. I ran three blocks and almost couldn't breathe when I got to the point where he was making a speech at a street corner in Kansas City, Missouri. And I'll never forget the thrill I got at seeing the man who represented the government of the United States in person. And I always have to think back to that when somebody comes in and gives me a lot of kudos and bows and things, because I'm not used to that sort of thing and don't like it personally. But there are a lot of things in the office of the presidency that I don't like, but that doesn't make a damn bit of difference. I have to take it anyway.
President Truman served nearly 8 years in office, and as his term came to a close in January 1953, he addressed the nation, describing the responsibilities of the office of the president and thanking the American people for their support during his White House years.
I'm speaking to you from the room where I have worked since April the 12th, 1945. This is the president's office in the West Wing of the White House. This is the desk where I have signed most of the papers that embodied the decisions I have made as president. It has been the desk of many presidents, and it will be the desk of many more. The greatest part of the president's job is to make decisions, big ones and small ones, dozens of them almost every day. The papers may circulate around the government for a while, but they finally reach this desk. And then there's no place else for them to go. The president, whoever he is, has to decide. He can't pass the buck to anybody. No one else can do the deciding for him. That is his job. That's what I've been doing here in this room for almost 8 years. All these emergencies and all the developments to meet them have required the president to put in long hours, usually 17 hours a day, with no payment for overtime. I sign my name on an average of 600 times a day, see and talk to hundreds of people every month, shake hands with thousands every year, and still carry on the business of the largest going concern in the whole world. There is no job like it on the face of the earth. In the power which is concentrated here at this desk, and in the responsibility and difficulty of the decisions. When Franklin Roosevelt died, I felt there must be a million men better qualified than I to take up the presidential task. But the work was mine to do, and I had to do it, and I've tried to give it everything that is in me. Through all of it, through all the years that I've worked here in this room, I've been well aware that I did not really work alone, that you were working with me. And now the time has come for me to say good night, and God bless you all.